increased rather dramatically with capital improvements for small water companies. So that's another part of the commission's business, and I think that kind of wraps up the industries that, we have jurisdiction over.
I'm sorry, Mr. Warren, how many companies did you say you did regulate, water companies, actually?
200? Very small companies.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't want to leave the impression that we're spending time regulating the rates of all of those companies, because we have many of them are exempt from regulation until either they're petitioned or rates get up there, get up to a certain size, or they get certain level of rates. We do with Senate Bill 712 require, there are now required that service territories be established for them, so we are regulating in that sense.
Service territories?
Service territories, exclusive service territories for them. But because they are small, there are, we regulate them, but the regulation is waived until certain things occur. What we are seeing is that because they're having to increase rates because of additional costs, some of which are related to health standards, that more and more are coming in for rate increases that require our regulation of them.
Perhaps you could just enlighten me, if you would, please, relative to 712, or Senate Bill 712, at what point do we begin to regulate as to these costs, where they have been wavered in the past? What is the cutoff point? What would cause a company to come across the barrier of a regulated or non-regulated to a regulated company?
Okay. There, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are really two cutoffs. One is price and one is size. If the utility serves 500 or more customers, or its average monthly residential rate exceeds $24, and 20% or more of its customers petition the commission requesting regulation of the rates.
20% or more?
Yeah, 20% or more of the customers petition.
So as to price, its average monthly rates exceeding $24.
Yes.
And or size of 500 or more customers, or I take it that a customer, a base of 100 customers with 50 of those customers asking to be regulated, petition for regulation, could then be regulated?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, it would be 20% or more.
20% or more, but 50% of 100 customers, that,
yes, that
even
would.
Though it's smaller than 500.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And the $24 rate, help me with that if you would please, Cherry, because that's been statute for how long?
I think we changed, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we changed that, raised the level in 19. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry, that's in rule.
It's in rule.
Yeah.
Okay, I beg your pardon.
$18 in the statute for the definition of public utility.
Okay, that's where I'm confused. According to the Attorney General's office, for definition of being a public utility, it's $18. But for jurisdiction over rates, we set it in rule at $24. And I think we did that 2 years ago.
So statute is $18, but by rule you've moved it to
$24. The statute is not for the purpose of definition of regulation. It's for the definition of what is constitutes a public utility.
Okay, I see. So at $18, it becomes a public utility. $24, it becomes a regulated public utility.
Okay. When it becomes I believe it goes like this. When it becomes a public utility, it's subject to our jurisdiction. Under our jurisdiction, we said we will not regulate the rates unless it's at $24.
Thank you, I'm sorry to put you through that drill.
Mr. Chairman, that's okay. It's probably good for me to remember those details from time to time.
And there's about 200 small companies, and how many of those are presently under this $18, $24 or 500 customer rule?
Mr. Chairman, we have to get back to you on that as to how many exactly are. We do have an increasing number coming in for rate increases, either because they are exceeding it or because customers are petitioning it. So I'm not sure the exact number right now. We can get you that information.
All right. I'm sure this is something the Legislative Fiscal Office would have at their access, but total number of people, full-time positions associated with the water regulation.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's two people full-time.
Okay.
And we have other staff that may assist those two individuals, but those two individuals' principal duties in the water.
Okay. And do we know the full-time equivalency of the additional staff?
Don't right off hand, but I know two staff are entirely dedicated to water.
Thank you very much. Please proceed. Senator, I beg your pardon. Senator, you is recognized.
Thank you. On your organization chart, 1-5, under utility program, can you tell me which square represents water regulation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, the Water Regulation Unit is under the what's called the Economic Research and Financial Analysis Division. That's a major division, and the Water Unit is a separate section under that.
Oh, uh-huh. And what does the 1 mean under division?
The 1 is a footnote over in the right-hand corner bottom that explains that division and some of the option packages we're recommending in this budget.
Oh.
Just a footnote.
Mm-hmm. I see. And the water is under
would be within that division, yes, ma'am.
Okay. I see.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions at this time? Please proceed.
Yes.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I'll start now on page 2-7 of the briefing book and go through some of the performance measures that we've developed for the utility program. The first one being was captioned residential average price of electricity, Oregon investor-owned utilities, or what we call IOUs, versus national. And that, what we're attempting to do there is draw relationships between the price paid for electric service by residential customers of privately owned utilities in Oregon, electric utilities, versus that paid nationally on average for residential prices for electric utilities. And the theme there is to observe over time and try, if we can, to the extent we can, to manage over time our price relative to the price paid nationally on average, and with the objective of trying to keep our price as low as we can, and with the utilities' cooperation, of course, and good work that keep our prices as low as you can in Oregon relative to prices paid elsewhere in the country. So if you look on page 2-8, you'll see a bar chart.
Senator, you is recognized.
Mr. Chairman, before we go to the next page, can you tell us what is the premium rate per hour, per kilowatt? Is this the unit you use to compare what it is in the nation? I mean, instead of saying we are below 70% of the rate pay, can you give us a unit figure that we can compare with?
You know, Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, I don't have a precise rate. I get that for you, but it's been slightly over 5 cents a kilowatt hour for residential rates. It's gotten a little higher recently with the cost increases. That would be for Oregon.
Yes.
And the national average would be, I'd be backing into that because I don't have that information available, but it's probably in the range of 7 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour, with Oregon's being approximately 70% of the national average.
Yes, if you could give us that information,
like
too,
sure.
For the past 5 years and for the next 5 years.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, the next 5 years would be speculative, of course. Both with Oregon, we don't know where the costs are going to go precisely, and it'd be even more difficult nationally because we don't have any idea of the cost nationally in that regard. So we don't have projections like that. We certainly can give it to you for the past 5 years.
Is that follow-up?
Senator, you're asking for a projection? Is that what you would like to have?
Yes. Could
we have a projection, Mr. Warren?
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, it would be with some speculation. Oregon, perhaps we might be able to give you some idea. Would it have to be based upon certain assumptions regarding inflation and cost increases? As you know, the market is awfully volatile right now, so it would be something that I wouldn't want to rely on as far as, and nationally, I don't think we can give you a projection nationally, unless there's a source otherwise from an economic consulting firm, perhaps, that has done research like that.
So you're interested in what the future is for Oregon, or may hold for Oregon and Oregonians.
Yeah, given you can give us the conditions that you are concerned with, given the prices and the implementation, but give us an idea. Because we have a lot of citizens who are concerned with
fixed income.
With the rate.
Income.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mr. Chairman,
mm-hmm.
Members of the committee, if I could. I think we can give you a pretty good projection within some reasonable range of what rates are likely to be like by the end of this year. Because we have a current rate case. We have a lot of material in that. I'm a little hesitant because I don't want to prejudge or give any indication of prejudging what the outcome of the two rate cases would be. But we do have a pretty good idea of what the forward market prices are in the Northwest that would affect the utilities. Going beyond that becomes very, very speculative and very difficult to do, particularly when we have an anticipation of a lot of new resources coming online, but we don't know what impact that's going to have. We don't know how much economic growth we're going to have. I would feel more comfortable giving you a short-term estimate or some range of the short-term. It's in, say, next year, maybe at the most even two. But going beyond that, I think, if I could be honest here, I think it gets speculative to the point of actually being a potentially being a disservice and not really because we don't know what the economic growth is going to be. We don't know what inflation is going to be. We don't know what the new generation impact is going to be. Well, there may be some projections through the U.S. Energy Information Association that can give some general national forecasts or things like that, but it gets, the farther out you get, it just becomes pretty speculative, and I'd prefer to just give a short-term estimate.
Is your concern to try and determine what a worst-case scenario may be for those senior citizens that are living on fixed income today, or?
Well, I still would like to see what their goal is. Their goal is to continue to regulate for a fair and reasonable rate, because we are not going into deregulation. We're going into restructuring. So you're going to continue to regulate utilities for a fair and reasonable rate. But then, so give us your best projection. And you can qualify by saying that you are going to face different situations. No, I don't want to hear the worst case scenario. I just want to see their goal under their present policy and under their mission.
Okay, I just want to make sure that what kind of sideboards you were trying to establish, whether or not maybe you and Mr. Yee could afford to meet the monthly power bill.
I have a lot of concerns.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have a lot of concerns.
And maybe with some inflationary factors in there and whatever kinds of information, but perhaps that's something that you could work on directly and privately with Senator Yee as to anything beyond the next couple of years, and then to satisfy Senator Yee's concern.
Well, I think it's going to satisfy the committee's request for performance measures.
Okay, and once you're satisfied that it does that, then we can bring it back to the full committee, Senator Yee.
To see if committee is satisfied.
Okay, please. Thank you, Senator Yee.
The second performance measure, Mr. Chairman, on page 2-9 relates to personal injuries related to electric operations. And this is an index that we use to, and the chart on the following page, 2-10, shows you the historical data relationships in terms of injuries per 100,000 of population. The point here being that what we're trying to do is minimize the exposure to the public and to workers around the power lines with respect to proper maintenance, tree clearance, correct installation of equipment on poles and the like, so that the amount of injuries involved tends to decline over time, trying to reach our target, of course, of zero injuries, which is difficult to attain in a regarding an issue that has such a broad application within all our communities. So our performance measure there is to try to get zero tolerance, I guess you might put it, in terms of injuries, but and we've been on a pretty good trend recently for the last 4 or 5 years.
And explain to me, I'm sorry to be asking this question, which is probably obvious on the face of it, the number of injuries that are actually occurring at this time are 0.58 injuries per thousand.
Per 100,000.
And that's within the state of Oregon.
Yes. The commission has jurisdiction over all electrical facilities in Oregon, both public and private.
So with 3.4 million people, there would have been, 20 personal injuries. Is that's an annual basis? Was it a calendar year?
I'll trust your math on that, Mr. Chairman. I don't have that figure right with me, but it seems like that would be derived, yes. I could get you the actual number. All I have here is the ratio. We have the actual data underlying each of those figures.
Yeah, 19.7 injuries, 20 injuries.
The case, yes.
This past year, any death injuries, and these are all publicly owned utilities, is that right?
No, these are private and publicly owned utilities.
These are private.
All electrical distribution systems in the state. Deaths, I don't know whether they were or not.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to recall a press release, and I think we got through without any deaths in the last year. But
wonderful.
I'm not positive of that, but I think we put out a press release on this, and I think it said that we'd gone through without any deaths. But that's subject to check.
I noticed that that's. I appreciate that the projection is hoped to be zero, but and the 1999 of the years depicted. The 8 years depicted is the lowest, the 0.58 per 100,000 population. Also notice that it goes up and down. Is there some reason for that oscillating nature of the injuries?
Yes, sir. But let me first clarify a point, if I could, Mr. Chairman. This is per 100,000 customers. I misspoke. It is not population. It's going to be different. It's going to be a much lower number than that 3 million figure you cited.
Okay.
So, but why don't we get you the actual information for the data points involved here.
And in that process, do you determine culpability relative to these measurements? Is there,
yes,
these
sir.
Kids flying kites when they shouldn't be?
climbing trees that are climbable and shouldn't be climbable because they haven't been pruned properly. Workers that work around power lines with aluminum ladders, painters. It could be almost anything. Yes, sir.
Irrigation pipe.
Irrigation pipe. Yes.
Right on end. And so that's per 100,000 customers. And you'll get us how many customers do we have in Oregon?
Well, there's about 1 million private homes. So why don't we get you that? It's going to be something over 1 million.
1 million private and
there's probably 250,000 public. So roughly, but. Why don't we get you those numbers?
I actually have it here.
And there's quite an education program that is put on by the utilities themselves.
You betcha.
Are those education programs equally spread between the private and the public sector of the two portions of the industry?
I think so, Mr. Chairman. However, the larger companies have more resources and probably bring to bear a little bit more in that regard. But there's a standing committee that all the electrical system owners participate in and meets very regularly, and they discuss issues of common interest and exchange ideas for customer information and dissemination in this area. I think the industry does an outstanding job of trying to prevent injuries through public information. In request to your inquiry regarding culpability, yes, we go out and look at accidents and try to determine what the reason for those accidents are. Our job, though, is not to determine culpability and liability in a legal sense, but to determine what the problem was on the system and make sure it's been corrected and try to avoid it in the future.
I guess that's why I ask Mr. Warren relative to the culpability. Certainly, I guess there would be a manner in which you could protect against injury incidents, probably to a much higher degree and actually get that closer to the zero. But can we afford that price? Because then, you'd have to have so many stop gaps in place that it would almost be cost prohibitive. And I just that's why I ask about culpability. If all the reasonable steps and measures are being taken, then at what point does stupidity and pure stupidity step in?
Chairman, I've been around my backyard with a aluminum ladder and said, whoops, wait a minute, I don't belong where I'm at. And that's, how do you prevent that? I mean,
okay. The Senator Yee is recognized.
Mr. Chairman, so how does Oregon rank in the cost of doing business? This is benchmark number 9. On page 29. It says labor cost.
That benchmark is from the Progress Board's benchmarks. It's a more general state-wide benchmark. We link it to our benchmark in a sense that, Senator Yee, what we're attempting to do here is minimize injuries and accidents and the cost of doing business in two ways. Number one, workers getting around power lines, becoming injured, and being and costs of hospitalization and that sort of thing, insurance costs. And the second being the liability for companies when their systems aren't maintained properly and citizens get injured, and there's a liability issue that costs the company to. So we try to keep those costs down, and it's linked in that manner.
So do you have a ranking? Follow-up question.
Follow-up question. Yes, Senator Yee, please.
Do you have a ranking for Oregon compared to national cost of doing business?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, we would have to go to the Oregon benchmarks to get that. This what I understood we were asked to do is identify which performance measures we had that related to or had an impact on Oregon's benchmarks. The benchmark we have is the residential, in this case, the benchmark we have is the personal injuries related to electric operations. The benchmark on business costs, number nine, is an Oregon benchmark that is affected in part on how well we do. But to get the information on what Oregon's rank is in relation to that benchmark, you'd have to go to the Oregon benchmark, the Oregon benchmarks, and I guess it's the Progress Board that keeps that information.
So are you saying you don't follow up? You don't have data relating to this benchmark?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, that's correct. This benchmark is not our benchmark. It is one of the Oregon benchmarks that is affected by our performance measure, which is the number of personal injuries. The presentation, as I understand it, wanted us to list our performance measures and identify any Oregon benchmarks that our performance measure relates to. That's what this does. The benchmark is an Oregon Progress Board benchmark, and they have the overall measurement for how the state of Oregon is doing that. How we do on personal injuries related to electric operations will affect the cost of doing business and labor costs. That's why we listed it here, according to what the request from legislative fiscal was.
So as to health, benchmark number 45, the accidents are listed. And as to the business costs, measurement of residential average price of electricity, Oregon investor-owned utilities versus the national. Is that correct? Is it
what I understand, then, the two benchmarks.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I
If we look at the two benchmarks that are listed at the top of 2.9, benchmark number 45 dealing with health, and that's that would be shows premature death years of life less than age 70. Is that related to the protecting the public health by eliminating electrical injuries relating resulting from hospitalization and death? I assume that's what that
is.
Yes,
sir, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then the business cost is basically Oregon's national rank cost of doing business. That, I think, that gets back to Senator Yee's earlier question relative to the projection in part.
Mr. Chairman, I think we listed benchmark number 9 in relation to personal injuries related to electric operations as well. If you look at the structure, and it may be some confusing by virtue of the structure, we started out with benchmark 7, the residential average price of electricity performance measure relates to benchmark number 74, housing.
That's housing costs.
Mm-hmm. And that's related to including utilities. Then if you go to page 2.9, we start with our other performance measure of personal injuries related to electric operations. That one we believe related to health and to business costs.
And the business cost there as well.
Yes, that's okay. Why they're listed on that page with those two.
Right.
That's
I
how we.
Pardon, I was having some problems relating business costs to the injuries, but I guess certainly it is a cost of doing business. So.
I think we did it in terms of the specific reference there to labor costs and the injury impact on labor costs.
Mr. Chairman, so you're saying that the loss in productivity due to injuries in related electrical work contribute towards doing business, cost of doing business in Oregon. So for our information, do you think we can ask Oregon Progress Board to give us information on benchmark number 9? So we can kind of tie them together.
I think that would be appropriate, and Mr. Trans is back in town, I know. I saw him last night at the airport. So maybe we could invite Jeff to join us during the public testimony, perhaps on Monday.
Maybe he can comment on where we are nationally in cost of doing business.
Okay, and certainly the overall cost of the price of energy would be one of those factors as well, I would think. So
that's not cost of labor.
No, that wouldn't be relative to cost of labor. You're exactly right. But the housing costs could certainly be addressed at that point, because that includes the utility costs.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I have another question.
Follow-up
related to injuries.
Yes.
Business in doing electric operations. Do we have any regulations banning overhead electric wires in new constructions in our state? Because all those overhead wiring contribute towards a lot of injuries. So with new constructions, do we allow underground wiring only now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, the answer is no. We do not require only underground wiring in new construction. There are many considerations. Many municipalities, I think, have considered doing that, but it is not. We do not have any requirement that all new wires go underground. Although I would say that. For new developments, that's probably a pretty common practice because it does save money on new developments. But there's no
saves money
going underground because mm-hmm. when you're doing a new construction, you can put a lot of utilities underground all at the same time. But I don't believe there's any there's no Public Utility Commission requirement. There may be local government requirements for new developments that do that, but it's not a requirement that we have.
Thank you, Senator. Please.
Chairman. I'll move now to page 211, which is the corresponding performance measure in the natural gas area related to injuries associated with natural gas operations. The same progress board benchmarks, number 45, health, and then number 9, business cost. The same concept entirely. We've been, I don't want to use the word fortunate, I think we've been very good to have an industry that's been very diligent in maintaining and operating their gas system so that we've had no injuries in the last 6 or 7 years at least. So you'll see our target is zero, and we've achieved zero, and not, I guess not we, it's the industry. And that's in light of the fact that the incidents occur in this industry, as you might guess, with dig-ins regarding natural gas facilities and pipes underground. In addition, there are some other issues related to protection of the pipe from leakage. Sometimes the pipes will rust out because they're not properly protected, and we have some exposure to the public in that regard. But we've had no injuries during this reporting period. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could also add, I think this is the natural gas area is an area in which we're proud of the emphasis that the agency has put on safety in both electricity and natural gas, and the attention we've given it, I think, shows. But in the book which we presented to you, there is a section called USA Department of Transportation report in which because we our natural gas safety has done a lot with federal funds, we have regular monitoring by the Department of Transportation, and I won't go into the letter, but we got pretty high marks. In fact, we were given 100% mark by the Department of Transportation. I think it's the second year in a row that we did that. So I might as well at least call that to your attention.
Mr. E, because who inspects the natural gas pipeline for safety? Is it by companies, by state officials, or by federal officials? And how often?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, the companies are required to install and maintain the gas pipeline facilities by a code. In other words, there's certain requirements for protecting the pipe, for how deep it has to be underground, and what type of facilities you'd cross under a river and all those sorts of things are set pretty much by code, and those codes are set by the U.S. Department of Transportation Gas Pipeline Safety Office. We're the agent, because we get federal funds, that inspects those facilities within the state of Oregon. So we inspect them. We don't inspect every foot of every line that goes in the ground, just like we don't inspect every foot of every wire that's strung out overhead for electric facilities. But we inspect the major installations. We watch for the maintenance that's done on these pipelines and so on. But it's basically the gas utility that's responsible for maintaining its system according to the code involved. And then we inspect those facilities as they go in the ground. When the trench is open, we'll go out and make sure that they're properly installed and that sort of thing.
Follow-up, Senator Yee.
Follow-up. So is there any – there's no federal inspection then? You say there's federal codes. But there's no personal federal inspection.
No, we're the agent for – they've retained us, in fact, to do the inspections for them, and they pay us through our budgetary process for our inspectors. We have 3 gas inspectors.
And you inspect them when they're installed, but do you inspect them regularly after that?
Yes, we do. Mr. Chairman, Senator, we inspect them when they go in the ground so that we can see the type of system that's being installed. And then, of course, if there's an excavation, they need to repair the line, or if there's a leakage or whatever, we will go out to the site and ensure that the work is done correctly.
Is there any – one more question?
Certainly.
Is there any inspection afterwards, like once a year you go check them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the pipeline operator, if it's a natural gas utility, is responsible for inspecting their own lines periodically. And what they do basically is if a line has a low level of leakage, and a lot of other lines have leakage that doesn't threaten the public at all, a low level, they'll inspect that a little less regularly than they will for a line that has a little higher level of leakage and so on. So, and then they'll repair the ones that pass beyond a certain threshold and create some kind of threat to the public, of course, or a potential threat. But it's a gas pipeline, gas utilities, natural gas utilities in Oregon, that are required to inspect all of their lines, and then we follow up with periodic inspections in certain areas.
Senator Clarnell?
I just was going to share with Senator Yee an experience I had of a gas pipeline company that took me on their plane route, how they fly every day and check the... And we went from Central Oregon down to into California and back up across to Medford, and I was really felt more comfortable and at ease about the safety aspects because of flying in that plane where they don't fly very high off the ground, so they can see, and they have monitor stations where they can see that everything's, there's no leaks and everything's very safe. So I felt a lot better about that.
Well, you can see, question for Senator Clarnell.
Certainly.
You can see the leakage from the air? No, you would not be able to necessarily see that, but they have monitoring places where that, if that goes into a computer and let them know, I hope I'm getting this right, that if there was any leakage, they would have that in with the technology we have today. But if you could see any damage, like a lot of these pipelines run through very rural areas, where if there was someone who wanted to be, like, electrical towers that have been vandalized, and if there was anyone that wanted to do something like that, they have everything they can see. It's the same as it was yesterday.
That's a frequent inspection, then, that's actually made by
air. I hate to say it was every day, but it seemed to me like this guy was in the air a lot. It was a plane specifically built for flying at low altitudes and being able to maintain that in any kind of weather and see the pipeline. It's very interesting. It's all kept quite clean, wide expanse, I'd say 60 or 75 feet, and it's very interesting to fly over. So maybe you can do that sometime.
Mm. Well, Mr. Chairman, because of the explosion in Washington, that's why I think people's focus is on more safety inspection, more safety measures that you can monitor.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator, you just follow up on that. The two areas that we focused on most in the last few years have been the replacement of an old cast iron pipe system that was in the Portland downtown area. It was installed literally at the turn of the century. It's a very decrepit, is a good word for it, leaky system that has now been fully replaced over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years with new coated steel pipe that will last quite a long time. So that was a major point of progress for Northwest Natural. And the other is we've had, with the wet weather in the last 3 or 4 years, not this year, of course, but the last 3 or 4 years, there's been increasing landslide potential. And in certain parts of Northwest Natural system, they've taken quite a bit of caution to go out and put in sensors in certain critical areas to measure the movement of the land so that the pipeline isn't stressed to a point where there might be a rupture and a gas incident.
I had just one question relative to the 3 full-time gas inspectors. You say that these are full-time employees within the Public Utility Commission that are gas line inspectors. Is that right?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
And this is done by fee from the actual natural gas utilities within the state to the Public Utility Commission?
No, sir. It's, well, half of it is. We're half funded by the federal government through their support, federal funds, and half through our gross revenue fee. And in that sense, we act as the federal government's agent to inspect the interstate pipelines within the state.
And this is, and I beg your pardon, relative to the, Mr. Warren, relative to your comment of the federal government paying half of the fee, you become the agent for the federal government on federal pipeline fees?
The federal
pipeline inspection?
Yes, sir. The federal government has jurisdiction over most aspects of the interstate pipeline system, which are the great big lines that run through the state, deliver gas in Oregon and go into California and up into Washington and so on. We inspect those facilities on behalf of the federal government and thus are reimbursed for that activity through that fund.
Assume that the federal government collects some fee then from the private-owned utilities and then basically pass it
out. What their source, if they may come out of the general funds of the Treasury at the federal level,
okay.
I don't know.
But then the other one half is from actual fee generation, I guess, in part of the natural gas industry that the PUC regulates. Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. Please proceed.
That concludes the discussion on the performance measures. On page 213 of your presentation notebook, discuss factors affecting services, including recent projected actions at the federal level. We've been asked to talk about that some. The lead-in issue is pretty obvious. I think most of the committee knows of them, and that's the bills that have required industry restructuring authority. And we've talked quite a bit about that in the last few days. Those two bills being Senate Bill 1149 and 622 in the 1999 legislative session. That's been a very, very large driver. Both those bills, of course, have been a very large drivers of the amount of work that we've had to do at the agency. In fact, I'd characterize it as probably the predominance of the work we do in terms of getting systems and processes in place to address the legislature's desires in terms of restructuring those industries. In addition, there have been orders issued at the federal level, notably FERC Order 2000, as discussed in the second paragraph of page 213, that requires the transfer of high voltage facilities to what they call regional transmission operators, or RTOs. What that means is the federal government's urging that there be a consolidated interstate transmission system for electricity that would facilitate the movement of electricity in a competitive market. Right now you have a lot of privately owned, in some cases publicly owned systems such as DPA that are kind of checkerboarded throughout this part of the country and throughout the country. And it's hard to move power contractually and physically through those systems because you have to address each one of them as you get to them. It's kind of like a toll bridge. Each one of them's a different toll you have to pay. So what's happening is the federal government's encouraging consolidation of those interstate transmission systems into one operator that can move the power more efficiently through that system. So that hasn't been totally achieved yet, but that's the ultimate goal. So that in the final analysis, if there's a customer in Portland, Oregon, who wants to buy power from a power producer in Wyoming, it would be easier for them to move that power over that long distance rather than going through three or four different utility systems.
So what you're explaining, Mr. Warren, if I understand correctly, the regional transmission operators at present would become unified in some sort of a federal transmission operation controlled federally?
No, not controlled federally, Mr. Chairman. The concept is not for public ownership. It's for a coordinated operation with continued private ownership.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add,
please.
The current transmission system is an interstate transmission system, so it is regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. However, it is very fragmented. It is owned. It does not have one ownership. It is owned by many different companies. I think if you looked at the Northwest connectors, including the connection to California, and you included BPA, you'd find that there are probably nine different companies that own them. Each one of those companies is also a generator, generates electricity. So FERC's policy has been to, in order to create open access and create a situation where the system not only operates more efficiently, but generators who own transmission do not have an unfair advantage over generators who do not own transmission. They have asked the transmission owners to get together and form regional transmission organizations that would operate independently of generation ownership. And
that is a divestiture issue then of the companies that are...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, divestiture is not required. It requires setting up a new board and turning over authority for the operation of it to a new board that can operate independent of the generators, but it does not require divestiture of the actual transmission resources, although there are a number of utilities in the Northwest that are considering forming a Transco in which they would divest their transmission resources into one new for-profit transmission company, but that is not a requirement of the federal regulators. The effort is to create something that has an independent board that would operate the system independent of the generators, but would at the same time allow the generators the recovery of the costs and recovery of their investment in the transmission but it's trying to create an open access so that there's no really, I guess one would call it market power, where a generator uses the transmission system to protect its own generation to the detriment of someone else who has generation but does not own transmission.
And that's in the process of happening right now?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and we have spent a great deal of time because this really affects how well the wholesale market operates and how competitive it is, which affects not only the price of generation, but it also affects the price of transmission. We have participated to a great a degree in monitoring the progress of that and participating with the trying to play a state commission role, not only with the federal regulators, but with the transmission owners as they develop their filing before the federal regulators on what the regional transmission organization would look like.
And have we had success in Oregon in this coordinated transmission system at this particular point?
Mr. Chairman, I think what we've had success in doing is making progress towards getting a regional transmission organization filing before the federal regulators. But we are still operating under basically the older existing system.
And so the regional filing, which is before the federal regulators, I guess that would be the FERC, is Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That regional filing before the FERC at this time is by the state or is it by the private companies?
Mr. Chairman, it's by the private companies. Well, not all of them are private. BPA is a major player here, but it's by the transmission owners.
And
I believe it was filed October was the first phase.
10 of 2000, October of 2000.
Yes, and there's a lot of work continuing. Commissioner Hamilton is our lead commissioner on that filing.
And the private companies joined in with the Bonneville Power Administration and are cooperating, and that's a cooperative effort then.
Mr. Chairman, I guess cooperative would be a good enough description, yes. It can be somewhat of a contentious process, but I think it's safe to say that it has made a great deal of progress and narrowed, the issues have been narrowed down to one or two fine points. I guess I'd say that I think that they've made pretty good progress. Commissioner Hamilton is agreeing, yes. They've narrowed it down. There are a couple of outstanding issues, but they're at the end point. They're not at the broad threshold point at this point.
This would seem to be, and just again, excuse me for my lack of knowledge relative to this particular specific area, but it would seem to be something which would be for the great benefit of the companies themselves. You say they've not all agreed to the points of the coordinated arrangement regional filing. What are the sticking points, if you could just share them?
Mr. Chairman, I think they've agreed to a bulk of the points. At this point, it has to do with the capacity rights and how those capacity rights, particularly for existing transmission owners and their customers, are treated. I think, though, that your point about the interest that's involved here is correct. This is an element of the outcome of this can affect the public in the state of Oregon a great deal, because this will affect whether or not we actually can get to workably competitive. Not only can we get to workably competitive wholesale markets, not only can we have an efficient transmission system, but it also is going to affect the ability to expand how and who expands the transmission system when we need it. We've identified this as a critical area of interest. It is not within our jurisdiction because it is federally regulated, but we have worked with the federal regulators. They have asked for our participation in our comment, and we spent a lot of time on it. We believe it's justified.
So it is a federal mandate that you're carrying out.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, it would be a federal request and a federal opportunity for us to participate and comment and influence these decisions.
Federal opportunity?
Mr. Chairman, it was required, the federal government required these filings. And then we being our national association as well as individual states like Oregon, became very concerned about the degree to which we would have any influence. So through working with the federal regulators, they not only gave assurances but made it as one of the principles that they laid out in their order of how to make the filing, that there be state participation in the consideration of the outcome.
I see. So the state enters this basically private market, with the exception of the Bonneville Power Administration, by invitation of the federal government then?
I think we pounded on the door loud enough that they thought it was probably a good idea to open it for us.
Okay. I guess I'd be interested, and maybe we could discuss in private at another time, and perhaps with Commissioner Hamilton, relative to the capacity rights and customer treatment issues. None of the transmission lines, I think that's, in some instances, we call that the grid, is that right?
Yes.
None of the transmission lines are owned by the state, they're all owned privately, or by the Bonneville Power Administration.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. They're either owned by privately owned utilities who also own generation, or they're owned by the Bonneville Power Administration, which in the Northwest, depending on how you define the Northwest, but owns about 80% of the actual transmission lines in the Northwest. But if you consider the transmission system where the Northwest actually gets its power and the connection to California, then you're into the Rocky Mountains, Idaho, Wyoming, Utah, where Montana and where Pacific Core operates, and California, and then you're looking about probably 9 to 10 companies that own transmission lines, including BP. Yes. Mr. Warren was suggesting we do have a map. I guess I didn't bring it with me. We do have a map that generally shows the transmission system, if you'd like to see it.
Okay. And again, by proponents, these are all private lines. The grid is privately owned. Did I understand you to say that, or is the...
Mr. Chairman, the state does not own any transmission lines.
Right.
It is privately, with the exception of the Bonneville Power Administration.
Which would be public at that point.
Yes.
In fact.
The rest is owned by privately owned utilities.
Okay. All right. I just was concerned why that, unless the state was required to get into the end of the regional filing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, how the state had gotten involved in that. And I guess it's by invitation from the federal government that the state could be a participant or should be a participant.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it was. I think what I'd like to emphasize is the critical nature of our involvement, because this affects the market from which the utilities have to buy. Utilities want us there as well, and it can have a significant effect.
So even though there's some sticking points, they still want the public utility.
Yeah, I don't. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Actually, the sticking points are kind of at the fine point. I don't think they are things that are going to make it all fall apart. They're just some things that haven't been worked out and completely agreed on. But by and large, they have agreed on a filing, and I think that's a significant achievement. But the nature of the transmission system, how workably competitive market you have, and how efficient it operates, affects not only the cost of the transmission system, it affects how well the wholesale market operates, and that's where we buy our power. And also affects being able to send the right price signals for where either new transmission or new generation is built. So it's a very critical. It is an issue of public interest for the state of Oregon, and that's why we felt it was important to participate.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to know what the state's participation and how private industry had reacted to that. Senator, you recognize?
Mr. Chairman, I'd kind of like to know, how does it increase, facilitate competition by regional operation of the transmission line? So you can use each other's lines in transmission of power, and that increases competition?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, maybe I could discuss with you just briefly what the natural gas situation is and show you how much more complicated this electric situation is, why it's necessary to go this route. With natural gas, we went through the restructuring about 10 or 12 years ago, and each of the components of natural gas of the natural gas system were owned by separate entities. The gas in the wellhead in the field in Wyoming or Montana was owned by the oil companies. The interstate pipeline that brought the gas from Wyoming into Portland was owned by a corporation that was regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We had no jurisdiction over that. One pipeline, one owner. The local distribution system, Northwest Natural, was owned by a utility in Oregon and regulated by the commission. As you can see, it was pretty easy to kind of restructure that system so that you could go out and buy gas directly from the entity in Wyoming and deal with one entity, Northwest Pipeline Corporation, to move the gas from Wyoming to Portland. Here what we have is a splintering or a whole array of companies, so that if you had the electrical situation of a PGE in Portland wanting to buy power from a producer in Wyoming, they have to pass through perhaps as many as Commissioner Rikas said, 6 or 8 different transmission systems now, and each one of those systems is owned by a different entity. They pay a different price. They may not have capacity to move it, and so on and so forth. So what the regional transmission operator will do is operate all those in concert, perhaps find different avenues to move that power. You go, it's kind of like one-stop shopping, I guess would be one way to put it. So you're dealing with one entity rather than 6 or 8 different entities. That makes it more efficient, makes it easier for power to flow and to open up the competitive markets.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't know that companies own parts of the pipeline. They don't own the whole thing, say, from Wyoming to Portland.
No, if you're moving power from Wyoming to Portland, you might go through Pacific Power System and then into Idaho Power System and then into BPA System and then into PGE System, very simply.
Certainly, Senator Yee.
So how do they do it now? Do they have to get a permit from each company when they transport the natural gas supply to Portland?
Well, I'm talking about electrical here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so do they have to go through permission from each company?
They sign a contract with each company.
To do it now?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
See, and when you want to open up to competition and let's say the large industrial users buy their own electricity in Wyoming, they have to do the same thing right now. This regionalization effort will make it easier for them to do that.
That helps a lot.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, please.
Okay. Sure. Continuing on page 213, the third paragraph there discusses very briefly the electric power supply situation that we're all familiar with and perhaps heard too much of in the last few months, but that's a factor that's affecting our workload and our business activities to a considerable extent now. We have two fairly major power cost dockets opened up for PGE and Pacific Power to somewhere or another recognize the higher power costs of the company are incurring to serve their customers and how to treat that for a rate making, in a rate making sense.
Excuse me for interrupting. The PGE and Pacific Power?
Yes.
And when you say two rate dockets opened up, does that mean filings before the Public Utility Commissions? Is that what those are?
There are filings. They're not rate dockets per se right now, Mr. Chairman. They're what we call power cost filings. The companies have not filed for price increases for these cost increases as of yet, but they are asking the commission to set those costs aside and somehow or another recognize those in rates later on, and that's yet to be decided. So it's not a rate filing per se, but it is an open proceeding. Both of those are open proceedings.
And so how does one open a proceeding without filing an actual power cost filing itself? Just, is it a letter? Is that what we're talking
about? It's a petition to the commission, Mr. Chairman, for a ruling by the commission to allow the company to set aside those costs on their books and come into the commission later and make a case for reflecting those costs and rates.
Okay, and the timing that it takes from the timing of the petition for a ruling until a ruling is made, and that's critical to me because I'm watching what happens in California as they go through this process, and the companies on a daily basis are talking about, I understand, hundreds of millions of dollars of loss in some cases.
Chairman, in this case, the way the law is constructed, once the company makes its petition, the commission, there's no statutory period that constrains a commission as to when its determination is made. We're going to go through it as expeditiously as we can. But the cost will be allowed to accrue from the date of the petition so that the company would be able to go back to that date and ask the commission to recover those costs whenever they're allowed in rates back to that the date of the actual petition filing.
How do you send a customer a bill for something that's 60 days old or 120 days old?
That's the uniqueness of that particular statute, Mr. Chairman. It does allow that retroactivity. Our statutes do not otherwise, but it does for what we call deferred accounting is what the term we use for it. In other words, we defer the accounting of that particular cost increase.
I'm particularly sensitive to the deferred accounting issue as to how long we may be looking in arrears. Are we talking 60 days or 120 days, we're certainly not talking more than that period of time, I wouldn't think, would we be?
Mr. Chairman, I think that depends to some degree on the situation. The purpose here of the deferred accounting is to avoid frequent full-blown rate cases. So you basically say, first you get approval. It occurs in two stages. First, you get approval to put the money in a deferred account. Then you have to file for amortization of the deferred account, in which it does start to get reflected in rates. So you have two issues there. And the timing may depend on what the utility will do once it gets the amount of dollars actually deferred. If the utility gets to a point where it wants it amortized, it will file to have it amortized and included at rates at a specific date. And then the commission can decide whether they want to do that or whether they want to take further time to consider it.
But with this deferred accounting, is there the potential that that at an earlier time a company could have used a great deal of electricity at a lower price and then not use as much at a later time when the price goes up and thus passing the rate on to the later consumer?
Chairman, those costs are balanced out. So if there's some pluses and minuses, they're netted out. So the company doesn't just collect the increases, keep the decreases. All of the costs are looked at in their totality over time.
But as to the individual customer, there's no accounting as to an individual.
Customer won't see a rate impact until the company comes to the commission and asks the commission to recover those costs. The commission may not allow full recovery of the cost. For example, the commission may decide to look at the company's earnings and see if they could absorb all or some of those costs. So if their profitability was such that they could absorb some of those costs, the commission wouldn't pass the costs on. I want to correct myself in one minor regard. Pacific Power does have an actual rate increase before us that the commission is considering next week. It's just in the neighborhood of 2 or 3% to begin,
3%.
About 3% to begin amortizing some of these costs. Now, there's not a lot of them, but they wanted to go ahead and start collecting them at the time they're actually incurring them.
3% per annum?
3% a year, yes.
Perhaps that addresses some of the concerns that Senator Yee had, that the Pacific Power has, in fact, filed a rate increase request for 3%, which would recover some of their costs, you see. Okay, I appreciate that explanation. Again, I apologize for interrupting.
We've been very active with respect to the fourth item on page 213 and engaging in the Vulnerable Power Administration's power sales proceedings. What that involves is Bonneville's going through an evolution themselves as to who ought to have access to the power that Bonneville sells.
And it's, as you can imagine, there's a larger demand for that power than Bonneville has in the way of resources. But they do have to serve by law the public entities in the region. They have some contracts with larger industrial customers, and of course the customers of the investor-owned utilities that we represent are also at stake there. So we've had, and Commissioner Eakins can speak to this because he's been our appointing commissioner on this, but we've had a very active participation in Bonneville's proceedings to make sure that we get the maximum amount of access to Bonneville's power that can be achieved through those proceedings.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this has been a process. This has taken a great deal of effort and attention over the last couple of years because BPA has been in the process of developing what they call a subscription process, or determining how their power would be made available to customers in the Northwest. And then they filed a rate case to implement that, and we have participated in that as well as negotiated with BPA. We've also to get greater benefits for the residential customers of the investor-owned utilities. And in doing so, we've had to work closely with all four commissions in Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and Montana to have a coordinated position on the part of the commissions. And I think we've actually been pretty successful in large part to the efforts, particular efforts of one of our staff people that we have, I think we will be able to secure significant benefits for the residential customers beyond what we had before we began this process.
And that's a BPA rate case pending, is that right?
Yes, BPA is, Mr. Chairman. BPA does have a current rate case pending, in which case we have actually negotiated a stipulation with the public power utilities and agreed on, for the want of a better word right now, and the method of allocation or method of access on the part of the investor-owned utilities to access to BPA's power. And for the first time, the utilities will actually be able to receive power from BPA, and for that amount that we do not receive power, we will receive cash benefits, and it represents a greater amount of power from BPA than we've had before. BPA is not, public power agencies have preference for BPA power. And the federal
public agencies, such
public
as
utilities, publicly owned utilities.
Oh, publicly owned
utilities. Yes, I'm sorry. Publicly owned utilities have preference to BPA's power. BPA is under the law and some provisions that could get pretty technical and complex. We got into it though. The residential customers of the investor-owned utilities are supposed to get some benefits from BPA, and this helps offset what rates would otherwise be. Now, this has been fairly contentious within the region, as you can tell, because BPA's power is fairly valuable and still is, even though they've got some significant rate increases coming up. So the environment in which we do this takes a great deal of technical analysis, and it's taken a lot of our time.
Representative Ringo is recognized.
The state of Washington has significantly more publicly owned utilities than we do, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringo, yes, that's correct. I think in general the ratios are about the other way around. We have about 75% served by investor-owned utilities and 25% publicly owned, and in Washington it's maybe about, you know, just conceptually it's pretty much the other way around. Plus they have many more aluminum plants than we do, so they get more of BPA power for them as well.
Washington residents accrue a lot more benefit from the cheap BPA power, and is there anything that this legislature can do to try to help pull that cheap power to the benefit of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringo, I think your assessment is correct. As to whether or not there's anything that can be done, I think that we as the commission have, and the investor-owned utilities themselves and some of the consumer groups, we've basically been representing the customers in these proceedings and trying to get greater benefits. I think the issue may go broader as to who really governs the river and whether or not it continues to be appropriate to have a BPA as a federal agency, and I think that the broader effort is the one that actually Senator Durfler and Governor Kitzhaber have tried to work on, which is trying to start a dialogue and look at ways in which the region itself could actually control BPA rather than it being kind of a federal marketing agency that, I don't know, you do not want me to start on my tirade of BPA, but let me point out that if, for example, in the rate case, BPA runs its own rate case. It is a lot like Portland General Electric running its own rate case and making its own decision, which fortunately they do not do. Nothing against PGE, but you don't want the utility running its own rate case and making its decision, and yet that's what BPA does. And I think because we have issues of the river that involve not only power but other things, that there's a desire to get more regional control over that. And I guess that concept would be how I would answer your question, that the best thing we can do is try and have a dialogue on how to do that. I think that will not only protect the resource for the region against some outside the region threats, but I think if we had that, it would enable us to have a better allocation of resources, BPA resources, among the region without necessarily threatening the public utilities preference.
Follow up, please.
Just a separate question. BPA has contracts with the aluminum companies that fix power, and so the aluminum companies are reselling that power, correct, rather than continuing to operate because they're making a lot of money. And I think one of those aluminum facilities is in Oregon. Is there anything this legislature can do to address what some people look at, perceive that situation as an unfair opportunity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringo, I'm not sure what the legislature can do, but I would point out, I think that the one aluminum company in Oregon is the one company that has renegotiated with BPA and has agreed to not to give revenues back to BPA, to share revenues with the workers, and to investigate utilizing some of the revenues for the building of actually new generation. I'm not sure what to advise you on legislative activity in relation to that one plant. I think it is the one plant that has done the right thing as far as renegotiating contracts with BPA.
Thank you.
Representative Smith is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a question of clarification. That company that's exploring new electrical generation possibilities, are they under obligation to, how far are they obligated to take that exploration?
I'm not sure what the contract there that says, and I'm not sure the details of the contract. Mark, do you? No, I think it's a exploration with BPA itself, because BPA is interested in new generating resources. I don't think that there are obligations, because I don't think enough is known yet about the financial consequences and the financial feasibility yet. So I think it is just at the exploration stage, but it may be maybe one way to not only provide new generation for the region, but to keep the plant economically viable and operating at some point in time.
Follow up, please.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a statement. The reason I asked that question is I know several companies, including the one that you're referencing, have been looking in the Columbia Gorge area east of the Dalles, and so I just was asking, trying to find out, is there a commitment in that, or is it just purely exploration? And you've answered that question. Thank you.
That would be, is my understanding, and Representative Smith, that we're talking about for location of additional electrical supply or relocation of a plant?
Additional electrical supply is what I understand, and they're looking at alternative forms of electricity production in wind, as I understand it, particularly in Wasco and Sherman counties.
And
if I may follow up on that, then a particular company then commenced to follow up on that alternative form of electricity within the grid, then would they automatically be immediately subjected to regulatory responsibility through the PUC?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, they would not. We would not regulate. We would not regulate that. It would be an independent power producer and would be selling, using it for either for its own. The aluminum companies are in a different category of retail customers because they're connected directly to the transmission grid, so they're considered direct service industrial customers. This particular one's also in a publicly owned utility district, so we wouldn't regulate the retail sales to them, nor would we regulate the power generation.
But they could sell into the grid at some point in time without regulation.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that would be wholesale market sales and under federal jurisdiction, and the federal government is not regulating the transmission, but they're not regulating the generation.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Last item on page 2-13 covers just a variety of other issues that are affecting our level of activities, including the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which most of you are aware of, other FERC decisions affecting natural gas electricity. That basically applies to issues such as pipeline rate increases that we get involved at the federal level. When they want to raise their rates, we tend to intervene and make sure that those rates are as low as possible so that the rate impact on gas consumers in Oregon is as low as possible. And the Safe Water Drinking Act, which, as I think we discussed a while back, affects the quality of water service and the amount of investment necessary by small water companies to provide water service to their customers. Page 214, we were asked to discuss our involvement in interagency and intergovernmental programs. We engage with several other entities within state government and other private groups that are involved in our proceedings. We do quite a bit of work with the Oregon Office of Energy, as you might guess, in terms of conservation programs, resource and policy planning activities, and industry restructuring for the electric and natural gas industries. We have participated in the state hydroelectric application review teams, which involves application of relicensing and other activities with respect to hydroelectric facilities in the state. We're a participant in that. We're not the principal of it. In the telecommunications area, we worked with many other commissions throughout the West. Western United States and what's called a Regional Oversight Committee, which attempts to address issues of common interest regarding Quest's activities in the Western United States. As you know, Quest operates in a great number of Western states. As I think we discussed yesterday, we're actively participating in the Committee on Regional Electric Power Cooperation, called CREPSI, which is a group that consists of PUCs and energy offices and other agencies in the Western United States in an attempt to address energy issues of common interest to the states in terms of transmission and resource development. It's another forum to make sure that there's a consistent thinking to the extent practical in the, among the various Western energy but utility commissions and other interests also. As you said, we work with FERC on a variety of issues. I think we've discussed that pretty extensively. One thing I'd like to emphasize, we do quite a bit of work with our consumer groups that are involved in commission proceedings, both in the energy and the telecommunications area. These consumer groups represent a variety of different interests, and they come in representing those interests discreetly so that they don't join necessarily, although they may have certain issues in common that they want to address. There are consumer groups such as the Citizens Utility Board, there are industrial customer groups on the electric and natural gas side, there are commercial interests in the telecommunications industry, commercial business interests that take telecommunication services, I guess I should say, to be better put. Those groups all have interests in what the commission decides regarding the rates and services for the various different utility services. And we work closely with them both in the proceedings that we're involved in and outside of those proceedings on a stakeholder type basis. Work closely with the Department of Administrative Services and Economic Development Department concerning telecommunications issues. A lot of those activities are driven by Senate Bill 622 and the need to address issues in that piece of legislation, particularly in the way of enhancing service to the rural areas of the state. And we work with the Oregon Health Department regarding water issues in terms of the quality of water service and the capital investments that are necessary to maintain good, high-quality water service for the small water companies the commission regulates. Questions in that area?
Sure. Other questions for Mr. Warren relative to page 214? Thank you. Please proceed.
Yes, sir. 215 is an overview of the commission's revenue sources. I think that Ms. Gates discussed this with you on Monday, so I won't spend too much time on it. We collect revenues from the industry principally to fund the commission's operations. For the most part, they're collected on the basis of the gross revenues that companies that operate in Oregon receive from their customers. There's a maximum of 25/100 of 1% assessment to fund the commission's operations for the natural gas and water utilities, and the same for the telecommunications providers. For electric customers, the utilities that serve them, the assessment is on a kilowatt-hour basis rather than a revenue basis. And as you may be aware, it was done that way a couple of sessions ago by the legislature to recognize the fact that the industry was evolving and restructuring. And much of the revenue that was once generated by a vertically integrated utility such as PGE might be separated, and the revenues generated by private entities wouldn't be under the commission's jurisdiction. So in order to maintain a stable funding source for the commission, the legislature decided that a assessment on the kilowatt hours itself rather than the amount of revenues would be a more appropriate procedure. Do you have any questions on the revenue side?
I apologize to members of the subcommittee not having been here on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. I just want to make sure that I understand that there are three different methods of collecting from the three different types of, from the types of industries being regulated. The 25/100 of 1% on the gross revenues, gross operating revenues of natural gas and water utilities that you regulate. And that's, and do I understand correctly that that's the statutory maximum and that you are at the statutory maximum now? You're collecting every bit of that. And that is based upon actual amounts that are collected as operating revenues, is that correct?
In the state of Oregon.
Okay, and within the state of Oregon, yes, sir. And that a sale of property is not considered to be an operating revenue?
Correct.
Okay, and then relative to the, and that was as to natural gas and water utilities. As to the revenues of telecommunications, it's 0.25% of the gross retail interstate revenues. Now, the gross retail interstate revenues, again, is within the state of Oregon, and it's on the, and here it's on the revenues themselves, not limited to the operating revenue. It's on all revenues?
Retail revenues, which would be revenues to an ultimate customer. Not a revenue that you receive on a business-to-business transaction when the service is going to be resold.
Okay, so this is to the ultimate user of the telecommunications. Okay, so a bundler of services for line charges and so forth, that would be based upon what they would sell for to the ultimate user of that service, and. the statutory maximum is the 0.25%, and is that the current amount which you're presently charging?
Yes.
Okay. And when we talk about retail revenues, and we're talking about telecommunications companies, do we also talk about other things that telecommunications may provide, such as Yellow Pages, separate and apart from the actual delivery of the telephone line charge? Do we talk about other kinds of internet services or other things that they may provide?
That's not internet.
I think it includes Yellow Pages because we approved that to the revenue requirements for retail sales.
I'm sorry I have to ask you these questions. You may have already answered them previously to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it includes Yellow Pages because there are no retail sales revenues involved in the Yellow Pages.
Okay, so we're only talking about the delivering of, I guess we could call it dial tone to me, to a customer. Okay. So it's based upon 0.25% for the dial tone of these telecommunication providers for the state of Oregon.
Well, there may be other telecommunication services provided, Kevin Butler, that say a telecommunication utility might sell other than dial tone. There may be other services that are set.
Oh, okay. So for call waiting, then you then you would receive the 0.25% for. Do we, and I'm sorry, Ms. McGlashan, you may have a complete breakdown of these resources and revenues. I know that as this evolves, basically you're taking apart the Gordian knot, and I'd like to find out what are the elements of what constitutes gross retail interstate revenues. When we start talking about that, because as this evolves, maybe a telecommunication provider. I saw a couple of heads shake relative to the internet services that the telephone company, telecommunications provider, may be selling. Is that not something we collect 0.25% through the PUC?
Mr. Chairman, we do not on the internet. Internet sales. It's not something that goes into the gross revenue calculation.
Okay. And in that regard, Cherry, could we maybe have a breakdown? I'm just curious as to what and if I could look at that with some detail, separate and apart from the committee. I don't need to waste the committee's time, but unless the committee would have some interest in the breakdown of that. Okay. Yes, the committee indicates that they would each like to have a copy of that 0.25%. And then finally, as to the third portion, the 0.018 cents per kilowatt hour for electrical utilities, and that basically limits. That's limited in regulation and statute. Is it? And are we charging that maximum amount?
Or not, it's not quite that amount being charged to PGE and PG&L, and a fair amount below that threshold.
Okay, do we know those amounts? If perhaps we could have that with the other
those two. It's
rate information,
a very small amount short of the maximum for the two large companies, and I'll get those.
Now those are statutory rates, Mr. Warren. Is that correct?
The 0.018 figure is a statutory rate.
Maximum.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The other rates are derived from a calculation of the commission's revenue needs and certain features in the statute that require us to keep a parity between the companies. So we go through a calculation to make sure the companies are paying their fair share, I guess is the way you put it.
Okay, and I beg your pardon, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the history of this is that back in the 97 legislature, when they passed this legislation, there was an interest in making sure that when we went from a gross revenue fee to a per kilowatt hour fee, that there was no shifting of responsibility between the companies. So it requires to keep a relationship between
the companies.
Yes, sir, and that's why the rates are a little bit different. None of them are 0.018 now, but the two large companies are close to that, and I'll get you those numbers.
Okay, but the 0.018 is basically the parity, the maximum parity that's established under the statute, is that right?
That's as high as you can go, yes.
Okay, now, Finally, Senator Yee, I think this may come back to one of the questions that you'd asked earlier. That's per kilowatt hour. That's not based upon dollars of revenue. And so as you conserve,
mm-hmm.
Or as you consume,
mm-hmm.
It's still just based upon the kilowatt hours, not based upon the way the company charges you necessarily for the kilowatt hours that you use. It's based only upon your consumption, and as your consumption increases, then you pay more, even if the price were to go down, that tax would remain the same, or could remain the same. Even if the price was going down, the revenue collected by the PUC, the state PUC, could remain the same per kilowatt hour. So you have the conservation. Any conservation, you're still paying the same amount per kilowatt hour used.
But Mr. Chair, if I could also point out, if you don't mind, if the price goes up, you pay the same.
That's right.
So we don't benefit from a price increase.
That's exactly right, and I wanted to say the inverse of it as well. I think you were concerned about perhaps the tax going up when you're still conserving and using the same amount. It would only be the actual utility that may have the price increase. You're not paying the PUC more in tax. Now, Senator Yee?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I understand more if I see the whole picture.
I think we'll get that whole picture, and then I think it addresses a part of what you may have been concerned about earlier. I want to ask this final question relative to the 3 points on page 11, on page 215. Does the PUC have before, or is there legislation pending or that you're aware of to be introduced, any changes relative to the three types of regulation or relative to the three amounts of charges that the PUC anticipates?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have not introduced anything, and I'm not aware of anything else.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Rengel is recognized.
Mr. Chair, it was a question for you as far as our schedule with regard to PUC. What's tomorrow or what's...
We will not be meeting tomorrow, and this is a time like this. We're in the middle of page 215. We're scheduled for Monday and Tuesday, potential work session on Monday, and scheduled public hearings Monday, and public testimony Monday. And by then, I will have had an opportunity to go through some of the tapes of the prior days as well. So any questions that I may have. Representative Ringel.
Just one more question. I would be curious to know more information on the implementation of 622, and you've discussed it throughout the last couple of days, but I'm wondering if there's anything more specific that you could bring as far as where those funds are going.
Mr. Chairman,
I wasn't here for the debate last time.
Representative Ringel brings up an excellent point, Chair Ekus, and let me just say this. And earlier it was mentioned, and it went through very rapidly, and I'm not having the benefit of the prior 3 days or the prior 2 days of hearing. We do have three brand new folks here that weren't around for the implementation of 622 or 1129. And 1149, I beg your pardon. 1129 is an income tax schedule that you don't want to monkey around with. In that regard, if there has not been a full discussion with regard to the deregulation bill, and then there was also, was it 3615, that there was an interim work group. Has there been any material discussion about 3615 relative to the findings of the interim study that was done?
Which one is 3615?
It was a House bill to have an interim task force.
Oh.
And I'm not sure whether we've each received a copy of that or not. I have received one, and Ms. McGlashan indicates that we should each have a copy. If you do not, please make arrangements to get a copy of that. It was an interim study of the structure of the PUC Commission, efficiencies, discusses efficiencies, and some of the issues, some of the areas of questions that I have been directing us to, direct in part to some of the findings of the House Bill 3615 study. And that would be an item that I would like to have us get a little further into, in addition to 622, Senate Bill 622 and 1149. Now,
because I just look at the budget thing, there's a lot of money, and I'd like a little more understanding of the where
and that's how it's going to be. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ring, if I could clarify a little bit of what you're asking, there are two elements there that affect a lot amount of dollars. And when you say spending, I think in the previous testimony we just tried to describe the sort of workload impacts.
Correct.
The two elements of the spending are the Universal Service Fund. The other is how is the money that U.S. West, being the one company that opted in under the form of regulation under 622. How is that money that they contribute a certain percentage of their gross revenues, how is that being spent? And that's actually not under our jurisdiction. That is under the Economic Development Department, and probably they would be the best ones to answer how that money is being spent. We could provide you with perhaps a description of how the Oregon Universal Service Fund actually works, but that is... That's the huge amount of dollars that are in that reflected in there are really for the Universal Service Fund, and that's so I wasn't sure when you said spending whether you meant how the U.S. West
just,
U.S.
The
West money
collected and then transmitted over,
exactly.
And then
okay.
we'll take up the economic development separately. So.
Okay, so I can provide information.
Your money.
No, I mean I didn't know whether it was the economic development, the telephone the company contribution to infrastructure, whether it was universal service.
Okay, and Representative Johnson.
Thank
please.
You. My interest, and I've spoken with Mr. Ekus about this away from the committee, my interest is in the composition of the committee that's going to be doing the public purpose program under 1149, and any additional information about that would be welcome.
Thank you very much. Representative Senator Yee is recognized.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to go into a work session next Tuesday.
I think we will schedule public hearing and public hearing and work session, but if we don't necessarily. Let me just share with the and I again beg your pardon for not having been here. I was at the behest of.
You need a translator, right?
Yes, and I did, at one place we didn't have a translator, and I don't do simultaneous thing. I want you to know that. I want to be sensitive. I want to be sensitive to the concerns of the members of the committee. We do have the recommendation of Representative Hill to come forward relative to the joint hearings which were held on Tuesday and Wednesday, and we will hear him at some point hear his recommendation, and then I would like to take the time that's necessary, and as necessary I want to be sensitive to our time, and we may want to start now looking at next Friday as a 1 to 3 session. So that we can start to, and we did this last session.
Vote no on that.
You can certainly vote no on that. We did this last session. We moved to Friday sessions for our particular subcommittee, general government subcommittee, last time, and in the afternoon, and we did so in order to make sure that we had every opportunity to ask the questions, follow up on the various performance measurements and those kinds of things. I just leave that open as an option. If Senator Yee votes no, then she's providing the party funds anyways. but that would move us to an extra, basically an extra one full day of hearing, and then we could hold that open for the time that's necessary for us to catch up if we do get behind.
Okay.
So, Senator Yee is recognized.
Are we going to hear the Residential Protection Fund explanation next week, or have we already passed it?
No, I don't know that we've heard that, and again, I don't have the benefit of having had Monday and Tuesday, or Tuesday and Wednesday here. Residential Protection Fund.
Just a brief overview, Mr. Chair.
Just a brief overview.
Yes. I just would like the agency to come in and give us a breakdown of the cost for the three programs under Residential Protection Fund,
the telephone relay program, the income subsidy, low income subsidy program, and the telephone device program. If we can have a breakdown for those three.
That's the next section of the briefing book we'll be discussing right after the finishing of the table.
Will you have a breakdown for the three programs?
The starting at page 3-1 for the remainder of that particular portion. Talks about the residential service.
Oh, yes.
That's the acronym. Questions and get the information.
That's the acronym RSPF.
I don't dare to say the acronym. And I have a question regarding what is the difference between operating revenue and retail revenue? What is the difference? Are they the same? I mean, by the time you provide service, it's at the retail end.
We'll be getting some breakdown on that, and then I think once we see some dollar amounts, we can ask specific questions, such as, is this the amount that people were billed and collected by the utilities, and those kinds of questions.
Yes, I just want to see what's the difference between the two.
That's an excellent question. Mm-hmm. It was a question that I raised on the floor the other day, specifically when we're going back for the $10 million. Is that amount billed or is that amount collected? Because the utilities are going to bill it, and then if they've got a write-off, they pick up their own.
Really quick, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I still am confused as to the role of the PUC in dam relicensing and siting of power generation facilities. And so if somebody could assist me in telling me how the PUC, not today or at this time.
Right. Perhaps by a separate meeting with Representative Smith.
I appreciate that.
And there's two or three people that are smiling in the audience, and that way we'll be able to have your question answered. With that, we'll go ahead and adjourn until even hour on Monday.